There's just one verse that we shall be looking at this evening, and only one. It's in John chapter 5. If you'd like to turn there, you'll have it when we want it. I thought this evening I would tell you about, this by the way is reason why I believe in Jesus Christ, number 4, the miracles. So I'd tell you about a visit I made to a university in the north of England. And it's quite a busy week that I had there, and everything was going more or less according to the schedule that I'd been given, until my host, who was on the staff in the university there, took me into a little dining room that was just reserved for faculty members. And it's a very beautiful little dining room, deep pile carpets, solid natural wood tables with a high polish on them, attractive menu, waitresses in black dresses and little white aprons, and all very tasteful, very sophisticated. It all looked great except for one thing, and that is that all the tables were so faced that they were looking in the same direction, and they're all pointing up to one little table with three places set. And I thought that looked a little sinister, particularly when my host guided me round to that table with the three places set, and he sat in the middle and asked me to sit on his right. And I said to him, "Who is going to occupy that other seat there?" And he said, "I'm glad you asked me that. It's somebody I'd like you to meet." I said, "Yes, who is it?" He said, "Well, you wouldn't know him." I said, "Then don't tell me his name, just tell me about him." He said, "Well, he'll be here soon, then you'll know." "Yes, but I would like to know before he gets here." "Well, you're not going to." So we sat there talking, the two of us, and the room filled up and all the places were taken. This buzz of highly intellectual conversation, when in came a very distinguished looking man. Everybody stopped talking and they waited in silence while he came around, and he stood looking down at me and he said, "You must be Mr. Needham." And I said, "Yes, I am." "And you are a Christian." "Yes." "Oh, let me shake your hand. I didn't think there were any Christians left in these days of advanced scientific learning." And he went and sat down in the other seat, and everybody was looking up, and apparently I was supposed to say something. So I said, "Yes, I'm a Christian. How would you describe yourself?" And he said, "I am an atheist." That is, of course, someone who says that God does not exist. There is no such person. And so I said, "Really, that's most interesting. Tell me, what do you do around here?" And that was slightly insolent, because he was obviously very important. "What do you do around here?" So I said, "I am the dean of the Faculty of Science, and I lecture in physical chemistry." So he was the head man on the whole science side of the university. So I said, "Oh, really? You call yourself a scientist then?" "I don't call myself a scientist. I am a scientist." "Really? Let me shake your hand. I didn't think anybody could be a scientist and an atheist." And now we really had an interesting atmosphere building, you know? People were definitely listening. And he said, "What on earth do you mean it's perfectly reasonable? I'm an atheist and I'm a scientist." So I said, "You're telling me there's no God?" "Yes." "Well, I would be most interested in hearing your evidence that God doesn't exist." "I would be most interested in hearing your evidence that God does exist, if you have any." I said, "Just a minute. I didn't say he did exist. You say he doesn't. So we'll take your evidence first." "Don't be ridiculous. You cannot have evidence that something doesn't exist." I said, "I know. It is ridiculous, but it's not my position, it's yours." "Well, when you finish playing verbal games, I would still be interested in your evidence that there is a God, if you have any." "Sure, since you admit defeat already. My evidence that there is a God is called Jesus Christ." "Jesus Christ? That's not evidence." "Well, Oh, just a minute. He was a real figure of human history. He performed miracles, and he rose from the dead. And that's evidence. The miracles. You don't seriously expect us to believe those fairy stories, do you? You have difficulty believing that Jesus performed the miracles? Absolutely impossible. Just nonsense. I would have to commit intellectual suicide to believe such nonsense. Well, would you like to choose one? Why should I choose one? They're all the same. Nonsense. They might have been included with Grimm's fairy tales. So I said, I would like you to choose because miracles are not your territory. They're my territory. I'm a Christian and I know about miracles. You're just a scientist, so you probably don't. And if we're going to talk about miracles, you at least ought to choose which one we'll talk about to help to give you something of the initiative back. So he said, oh, well, wasn't he supposed to turn water into wine or something? I said, yes, that's right. He did turn water into wine. If you've forgotten the occasion, it was like this. There was a wedding, and their weddings lasted several days, and they had plenty to drink. But they didn't have enough because they ran out. And it would have been very, very embarrassing for the host. But before the people found out, they brought the situation to Jesus. He'd never done a miracle before. And they brought the situation to him. He pointed to some pots of water that were for washing. And he said, serve that to the guests. And they did. And when the chief guest tasted what he was served, suddenly his eyes lit up and he said, hey, this is good stuff. It's not like that cheap rubbish you gave us at the start of the wedding. This is much better. Most people don't usually do that. They usually give us the good stuff while we're sober, and when they think we're too drunk to tell the difference, then they bring out the cheap stuff. But you've done it the other way around. My congratulations. This is excellent. And he had no idea where that stuff had come from, but that was his testimony. He was obviously a man who knew his wine, knew how it tasted, knew what it looked like, and that is his verdict on that wine. He was there. I wasn't there. You weren't there, but he was, and that's what he says about it. And because of that, people began to believe in Jesus on that day. And they, when they believed in him, they were prepared to die for him, and many of them did. And that's evidence. They were there and we were not there. That's what they said that happened. And they were prepared to die for it. That's evidence. Well, the dean looked around and he said, well, there you are. You're never just going to believe that, are they? Water turned to wine. Have you difficulty believing that Jesus turned water into wine? It's not difficult. It's impossible. Well, why? Because water does not turn to wine. Have you never seen it? No. Have you? Yes. I beg your pardon. I said, yes. When? Hundreds of times. Where? All over the place. I don't believe you. Well, I know. But that's your problem. I'm quite serious. I've seen water turn to wine all over the place. You ever seen a grapevine? What does a grapevine do? Puts its roots down into the soil and it drinks what? Water. Water? And out of the other end we get grapes which contain grape juice, which is essentially wine. Isn't that amazing? Now in England we don't grow many grapevines. The climate's not right. So instead of that, we don't turn water into wine, we turn water into beer in large quantities. And in order to do so, we build what is known as a brewery, or a chemical factory. And a chemical factory turns water into wine, and water into beer. When God wanted to turn water into wine, because the water wasn't safe to drink, and Coca-Cola were not yet in business, he didn't build a chemical factory, he designed a grapevine. Not big, as a chemical factory is big, but little. Not ugly, like a chemical factory, but relatively decorative. not noisy like all the chemical factories I've ever visited, but I have never met a noisy grapevine. They're all absolutely silent. And not dirty like a chemical factory, not polluting the atmosphere, etc., actually cleaning it up. Takes out the carbon dioxide that we breathe out in our cars produce, etc., and takes that out and pumps back in oxygen so we can breathe a little longer. And this little plant sits there, being small and decorative and quiet and clean, and turns water into wine at the same time. See, and it is actually quite a remarkable process. Now, Jesus was different from most people in that he could see, and most of us can't. And when he looked at the grapevine, he saw an absolute masterpiece of biochemical engineering that God the Father had put together in a package to turn water into wine. And when he looked at the grapevine, he saw a plant that turned water into wine because it was a creative miracle of the Father. Other people looking at grapevines just see a grapevine. Or having a glass of grape juice on the table, it's grape juice. And they never see the amazing process by which water has been changed into grape juice or into wine through the grapevine. They just don't see it because we're blind. We're all blind in our hearts. And we don't see the miracle in nature. Now in John 5 and verse 19, Jesus describes his miracles very carefully. Jesus gave them this answer. I tell you the truth. The Son can do nothing by himself. He can only do what he sees his Father doing. Because whatever the Father does, the Son also does. And when the Son looked at the grapevine, he could see his Father turning water into wine, and thought, if my Father does that, I will do that. I only do what I see him doing. I don't do any old daft thing like turning stones into bread. I don't do that. But I do what I see him doing, and he turns water into wine, so I will. So the first thing that the miracle says is this. Man, you are blind to the miracle of nature staring you in the face in the plant called the grapevine. You never saw what an incredible plant it really is. Jesus saw it, but you didn't. Now, when we'd gone over this, the dean interrupted me and he said, excuse me, but there on the table is a glass of water. You turn that into wine now, and I will take you seriously. I said, thank you. You really wouldn't have much choice, would you? But thank you for reminding me of one of the reasons why I believe in Jesus Christ. And one of the reasons why I believe in Jesus Christ is that I do not know how to turn water into wine. I lived 2,000 years after he did. I have a degree in chemistry, and I haven't the slightest idea how to turn water into wine. That's why I think it quite remarkable that he did. And he's the only person I know who can do it. That's why I believe in him. But I tell you what, you go to your laboratory and produce me a grapevine out of your laboratory, or even a seed so I can grow my own, and I will take you seriously. But you know, he didn't know how to do it. The second thing the miracle says is this, that Jesus is one with the Father. See, which is the bigger miracle, would you say? Which is the more difficult thing to do? To turn water into wine or to create a grapevine out of nothing? If you're not sure of the answer to that one, which do you think is easier? As far as I'm concerned, they're about the same because I don't know how to do either. And the only person I know is God, and he can do them both. So they're about the same. See? And Jesus shows the same creative power that God has. Only God knows how to turn water into wine. And the miracle says in the second place, man, the God who designed the grapevine to turn water into wine has just appeared to you again. His name is Jesus. don't be put off by the fact that he just looks like a man. He has done what only God can do, that is turn water into wine. He didn't do it the same way that the Father did it. There wasn't time for that. If he'd started growing grapevines and picking off the fruit and taking off his socks and walking on the grapes and squeezing the juice out and collecting it and decanting it and letting it settle and decanting it again, bottling it for a couple of years until it was ready to drink, they would probably have got thirsty before that. So he didn't do that. It was a different process, but the same end result, water to wine. And only a little quantity, about 600 gallons. See, the Father produces millions every year. Jesus just did a little miracle, a speeded up one without going through the grapevine process, the same end product. The dean was not happy. He wanted another miracle, so I invited him to have one. And he chose this time to talk about the feeding of the 5,000. And we rehearsed the details of that. Five little loaves of bread, such as a small boy could eat for one meal. Two small fish, probably sardines. Maybe undernourished sardines because it was a poor country. And two little fish, five bread rolls, 5,000 men, women and children as well. They all eat all they can eat and they're hungry. And you know what people do in an all-you-can-eat restaurant. And they really gorged themselves on this lot, but there were still 12 baskets full of fragments left over. The disciples collected those baskets. They had the five rolls and two sardines to begin with. They presumably ate what was in the baskets. They saw the whole thing from start to finish, and they wrote about it, and that's evidence. No evidence he did not do it. All the evidence says he did do it. If all the evidence says he did, then you've got to believe it, if you want to be intelligent. But the dean objected. Absolute nonsense. You have difficulty believing that Jesus could multiply food? Of course! Food does not multiply. Do you know, if you get two sardines together in the ocean, in the space of a year you get about 500 million. If you know, there aren't too many sharks around, you choose the right kind of sardines to begin with. About 500 million. It's quite exciting if you're a sardine. And sardines multiply. And every year the farmers do the dumbest things. They go out with their tractors, plow up the land, and bury in it perfectly good grains of barley. Grains that could have been milled and turned into flour, baked into bread, and we could have eaten it. And instead of giving it to us to eat, these dumb farmers insist on burying it in the dirt. Now, who wants it after it's been in the dirt? But the farmer knows what apparently the dean doesn't know, and that is that barley multiplies. And you put one grain in there, and you get 40 out. See? And 4,000% in 3 months isn't a bad interest rate, even for a farmer. See? And barley multiplies, and sardines multiply. And all our food supplies multiply. Now, maybe when you're at home, occasionally you get this cardboard packet and you turn it upside down and you shake out the sun. There's this golden cascade into your breakfast dish and you say, Kellogg's have done it again. I don't know how they manage it every day. It's not Kellogg's. Then you go down the street and you see the golden arches, or whatever it is. 59 billion hamburgers sold to date. Out of 4 cows, that's got to be a miracle. And everywhere you look, food multiplies. Fish multiply, animals multiply, little two-legged egg factories, bigger four-legged milk factories, food multiplying all over the place. And every day you eat the product of it. And you fill your stomach with it 3 times a day. Suppose we could single you out from all the rest of us and get together in here all the food you've eaten since the day you were born. Wouldn't it be impressive? Multiply that by the number of people in the world. How many people in the world? 5,000 million. And everybody eats something. They don't all eat as much as you do, of course, but they all eat something. Otherwise, it wouldn't be here. And they eat, and every one of us eats the product of multiplied food, but how many of us, quite frankly, see the miracle of the way it's produced? And that every day, the Father multiplies food so that you can stay alive. So the feeding of the 5,000 says again that Jesus is one with God. The God who designed the sardine to multiply and the barley to multiply has just appeared to you again. He may look just like a man, but he's not. He's your God. He's done what only God can do. He has multiplied food. Well, the dean was still unhappy. And now he wanted to talk about the healing of the leper. And he was very graphic about this because he'd actually seen a leper and he described one in great detail. A person in an advanced state of leprosy has no nose and no lips, just a hole. No ears, no fingers, no toes. All the skin shows evidence of infection. He's got leprosy. And he described all this and he said, then we're supposed to believe that this Jesus person came along and touched him and bingo. He grew new nose, new lips, new ears, new skin, new fingers, new toes. Rubbish. And I said, you have a problem with that. And he said, anyone of intelligence would discount that immediately. Why don't you believe that Jesus could make a sick person well? Because sick people don't get well. Really? What kind of people do get well? I thought it was only sick people that did. Now suppose I cut myself. I'm not going to do it because I like myself too well, but suppose I do. And the same blood which has been racing around, the same blood which has been crawling sluggishly around my body for the last few days begins to spurt out of the cut. But as soon as it begins to come out, it slows down even more. It's a really bad cut. I will go to the doctor who will clean it, stitch it, put a bandage over it. What will he not do? He will not heal it. Why won't he heal it? Doesn't know how. But he'll do all those other things, and then that same blood that has been running around my body, coming out of the cut, slows down, thickens, and forms a hard protective covering right across there. It seals all the dirt out, and it holds the edges of the skin fixed in position. Underneath that hard covering, the skin begins to knit itself together again. When that process is complete, the anchorages of that hard protective covering start to become loose and it falls off, and my hand has repaired itself. I can be a little more graphic and break a finger. There it is, hanging down there. And I walk in to see my doctor with my finger like that, and he says, oh, that's interesting. You want to keep that? I've never seen one like that before. And I say, I liked it better the way it used to be. So he says, all right, I'll put it back for you. And I said, just a minute. Suppose you give me an anesthetic first. So he gives me an anesthetic, and then he straightens the finger out and sets it in a plaster cast. What does he not do? Doesn't heal it. Why? Doesn't know how. But inside the plaster cast, that bone knits itself together again. Actually stronger at that point than before I broke it. My hand's fixed itself. That technology is quite something. Can we, for instance, make cars like that? Suppose we could. So you could borrow Jeff's little black Prelude. You can drive down to Comfort in it. bump into a few friends. And you drive back up here, and you think it's so boring using the same silly pedal to stop it every time. Let's try the wall of the chapel, see if that works. So you drive it into the wall of the chapel, and you find that actually the chapel wall stops it much more effectively than the brakes ever did. There is, however, a sort of a tinkling sound as the glass drops out of the headlamps and the windshield, and there's a dull clang as the front fender falls off, and there's a scrunching noise as the overall feet length is reduced by about 2 feet. And Jeff comes around the corner of the building looking definitely preoccupied and concerned. Not about you, of course, just about the car. And he says, "Look at my car!" And you say, "Yeah." "Well, what a mess. It's got no glass in the headlamps or the windshield. It's 2 feet too short. It's got no front fender on it." You say, "Relax, Jeff. It's okay. It'll be better in the morning. It will grow some new glass and some new paint and straighten itself out again." Now, if we could make cars like that, I would buy one for my wife tomorrow. But our technology is not yet up to that. But while our technology is not up to that, as far as making cars is concerned, somebody designed you so that your body would. And it's an amazing process. Just because it's common, don't let that blind you to the fact that it's marvelous. And every one of us has seen it happen in our own body. You've cut yourself somewhere. Every one of us has. If your fingers were made of any material you care to choose, platinum, stainless steel, carbon fiber, anything you care to choose, by the time you were 10 years old, you'd have worn them right off and you wouldn't have any. Instead of that, not only do you still have them, they're bigger than they were when you were born. The mechanics of that is quite interesting. Try designing a car that will fit a 2-year-old and will grow every year he grows, and all the relevant parts will grow with it to fit an adult. Amazing, amazing piece of machinery you walk around in. And Jesus could see. He could see the Father healing people. Just as he could see the Father multiplying food, and he could see the Father turning water into wine, he could see the Father healing people. This is whatever he does, I do. Father heals people, I heal people. So he healed a leper. Big deal. There's only one leper. Well, once it was 10 lepers. Father heals thousands every day. And yet we are blind to the miracle in nature of the way our own bodies heal themselves. And so the healing of the leper says to you, first of all, man, you are blind to the natural miracle taking place in your own body. You don't see it, probably because you don't want to see it. And the second thing it says is that the God who designed your body to heal itself has just appeared to you again, done what only God can do, heal the sick. But each miracle has also a third message. Every time Jesus does something, he produces a change. So when he turns water into wine, what does he do? He takes something that's very ordinary and very common and he makes it special, exciting and expensive. Jesus loves to make the ordinary special. And one of the big problems of today is this, that people have ordinary lives. I will use a more modern word than ordinary, and it's the word boring. And people have boring. That's all right, Audrey. It's all right. Just wipe it off before it hardens. Okay. People have boring lives. In England, the kids don't say the word boring, they sing it. Boring. Did he go to school today? How was it? Boring. See the telly last night? Boring. And everything's boring. And it's the same in your country. I've never seen so many bored people. And yet there are more entertainments, more education, more travel, more variety of everything in the stores, more opportunities to study anything you want to study. Why are people so bored? But when Jesus got that water, the water was placed at his disposal. And under his orders, it was then poured out in the service of people as he directed it. And what he's saying is this: if you will put your ordinary life at his disposal and then let it be poured out in the service of other people as he directs you, that ordinary life will become special. If you want to sit around for the rest of your life, you know, and never really do anything, but have Jesus transform everything so life is wonderful for everyone, it's not like that. That life has to be given to him. You've got to abandon it to him. He doesn't just touch you with a magic wand and that's it. You've really got to give your life to him. And that once you've given it to him, then you must do with it what he directs, because it belongs to him now, not to you. And as you pour it out in the service of other people, which is always what he will direct you to do, and as you begin to serve other people in obedience to him and in expectation of him blessing them, you'll discover that as a byproduct, your ordinary life becomes special. It really does. The one person who I believe was never bored in the whole of his life was Jesus Christ. Didn't have any money, didn't own a house, didn't have a car or a motorbike or even a donkey. But he was never bored. Didn't play football, didn't watch television, never saw Pac-Man, but he was never bored. I love, he says, to make the ordinary special. I know how to do it, I did it. You've seen me do it, turning water into wine. Now let me do it for you. Then when he takes the 5 rolls and 2 sardines and he feeds the 5,000 with them, there are various ways you can look at that. The obvious way to look at it is this: he takes that which is pathetic and he makes it more than enough. And when you look at the needs of your own world in which you're growing up, your ability to meet those needs is pathetic. It really is. I don't want to cause unnecessary embarrassment or heartache, but if, for instance, your parents are going through a divorce, not a lot you can do about it. You can't change them. And your contribution is pathetic. See the needs in your own society, the way it's falling apart. What can you do about it? The drug trade, pornography. Are you really going to make an influence in that? Of course you're not. Your resources are pathetic. Can't alter it. But in the hands of Jesus, 5 rolls and 2 sardines were more than enough for 5,000. The pathetic became sufficient. And if you will really put your life in his hands, what you'll discover is this: he can do with you things that you could never even begin to do by yourself. And he's the explanation every time. That's the way it's got to be. And in his hands, the pathetic is more than enough. And then, some years ago, I was in a church in New York State, and it was a terrible, terrible time. Have you been practicing those again? How long does it take you to get them to that, you know? And here I was in this church, and I'd preach 3 times Sunday morning, Sunday evening, Monday evening, Tuesday evening. Nothing was happening. And I was just frustrated, and I wanted to go home. And I was staying in a very interesting house, a very strong-minded lady. Her husband did as he was told. Kids did as they were told. The dog did as it was told. And I tried. And when we got to church, it was very similar. This lady was the organist. And they had a very large organ in this church with a tremendous volume. And she played it pretty near to the top of its capacity. Great volume. But every fourth or fifth note she hit was unexpected. And they had a reasonable sound system in the church, and I had a microphone, but even with a microphone, I could not sing in competition with the noise of this organ. It was colossal. In fact, in the whole church, there was only one sound louder than the organ, and that was the lady. Because she was a kind of a frustrated opera singer, and she got a very powerful voice. And she could actually sing louder than that organ without a microphone. The only thing is that when she sang, every fifth or sixth note was unexpected. It wasn't the same unexpected one that came out of the organ. And the result was terrible. And after two verses of the first song, I just gave it up. There was absolutely no point in trying to compete with this noise. And looking around the church, everybody else had given it up months ago. And we were back in the house after the Tuesday evening meeting, me wanting to go home, when this lady said, "No, Laura, that is not what she said." She said, "Do you know, the world is sick." I said, "What did you say?" And she said, "The world is sick." I said, "What on earth do you mean?" And so, I don't believe it. "We're sorry to see you go, Lord, I think." "The world is sick." "Well, what do you mean?" "Well, look at Northern Ireland," she said. Of course, she'd never been there, but she knew all about it. And she told how they were just blowing each other up in Northern Ireland, etc., and shooting each other. And she said, "You see, the world's sick." And I said, "No, that's Northern Ireland." So then she started talking about the Middle East and everything that's happening there, Jews and Arabs and Iran, Iraq, etc. And she said, "See, the world's sick." And I said, "No, that's the Middle East." So then she started talking about you people, the juvenile detergent. And the things that she said about you and the names she called you, this is terrible. And she said, "You see, the world is sick." And I said, "No, that's the young people." So then she started talking about divorce statistics in America. And I glanced across at her husband, and his burning ambition was to be the next one. And and she said, "You see, the world's sick." And I said, "Just a minute. You've convinced me. You really have. You've convinced me. How about you?" "What? How dare you? And in my own house as well. Nothing wrong with me. If the world was like me, it would be wonderful." I said, "Do you mind if I tell you something? If the whole world was like you, I would get off it." Now that lady is something of a caricature. By the way, I wish you could meet her now. She's different. But many people, she's not the first or the last to tell me the world is sick, and I'm sure you've heard something similar. And I don't think it's terribly healthy myself. But as soon as somebody tells me the world is sick and I say, how about you, they all sound fine. And I'm left with this amazing mystery of a sick world with no sick people in it. Can you understand that? If the world is sick, and I believe it is, then who are we talking about? Is it always somebody else? Or when we say the world's sick, are we talking about me and are we talking about you? If the world is sick, are you not part of it? And we suffer from a disease which isolates and hurts. It's called sin. It shows up all kinds of ways. And it affects and contaminates every relationship we ever make. Every one of your relationships is spoiled by sin. And it will be as long as you're here on earth. My most special one is my marriage. It's contaminated by sin. Not so much mine, of course. But it is. It shows up in little, petty, selfish ways. Like, for instance, both my wife and I find it hard to get up on a winter's morning. Now, I know you don't have that problem. You just leap out of bed with a happy hallelujah. But we don't like getting up on a winter's morning. And it used to be that the alarm would ring, and it would be still dark, cold, and she would jab me in the ribs with that elbow that wives sharpen for these occasions. And she would say, your turn. Now I'd say, what on earth do you mean? And she'd say, get up. And I would say, you get up. And then she would say, be reasonable. And I would say, I am. Reason tells me that it's just as reasonable for you to get up as it is for me to get up. And then she would say, but I got up first yesterday. Now, it's completely unfair because neither of us have the slightest idea at that time in the morning who got up first yesterday. But she has claimed that territory, and short of blood, it will not be taken from her. I got up first yesterday. Maybe you did. But you went to bed first last night, so you get up first this morning. So, here it goes, backwards and forwards till lunchtime. This is not good for the job. And the kids are getting ready for breakfast. So then we bought this wonderful machine, second hand. And you put it beside the bed. And you set it for about half an hour before you want to get up. And it switches itself on. And it boils some water. And when the water is boiling, it pours that boiling water automatically into a teapot with some tea in it. And it makes you a pot of fresh, hot tea. And when it's finished pouring the water in there, it lights a lamp and rings an alarm. And you wake up, the light's already on, and there's a pot of fresh, hot tea right there beside the bed. But the light was terribly bright, hurt the eyeballs first thing in the morning. So we took the bulb out and we put a little pink one in, which was much better. But that alarm was terribly loud and it just set your nerves on edge when it went off in the morning. So we disconnected that and fed the wires instead into a tape recorder with some nice gentle music on it, volume turned down. And now we wake up to gentle music playing, a Hawaiian sunset, a pot of fresh hot tea, and fight about whose turn it is to pour the tea out. Because it doesn't matter what level you live on, selfishness is still selfishness, and it still contaminates, it still spoils relationships. And you suffer from that disease called sin. But Jesus loves to make sick people well. And if you're aware of ways in which that disease is spoiling your relationships in your life, if you will bring that area of your life out into the open and ask Jesus Christ to deal with it, he will. And he says, look, I know how to make sick people well. I did it with a leper. Now let me do it for you. I've proved I am. I'm God. I'm the God who design the grapevine. I'm the God who designed the sardine and the barley to multiply. I am the God who designed your body to heal itself. I've proved it. I came here as a man and I turned water into wine. And I fed 5,000 people with 5 rolls and 2 sardines. And I healed 10 lepers. And I raised the dead. And I'm your God. And I want to make your ordinary life special. I want to make your pathetic life sufficient. And I want to touch you at the point of your sicknesses and heal you and make you whole. You've seen that I can do it. Now let me do it with you. We'll pray together. Father, thank you again for the Lord Jesus Christ. For that beautiful life that he lived here on earth. For the way that he demonstrated again and again and again. He's God. And thank you, Lord. Thank you that I can truly believe in him. And thank you that these weren't just displays of power, they were signs that I might understand what it is that he really wants to do for me. And I believe in my heart that Jesus came to earth not just for the world, but for me personally. And that for me personally, he died and rose again. And that he can do for me these beautiful miracles that we've been discussing here tonight.